This podcast is brought to you by lineupmedia.fm.
You're listening to This Day in History, a podcast dedicated to examining history from a standpoint of determining which event on any given day had the greatest impact on our lives. Now your host, Tony Hubert and Armand Kachigian.
Welcome into the program, This Day in History on lineupmedia.fm. Tony Hubert here, Armand Kachigian, my co-host. As today, on This Day in History, Armand, we bring you November the 28th. What might have happened on that day, you ask?
Plenty.
Plenty did, in fact. Let me take you to 1520.
Right.
After getting around the southern end of South America, three ships under the command of Portuguese explorer Ferdinand Magellan reached the Pacific Ocean, becoming the first European ships to sail from the Atlantic to the Pacific.
Right.
1520, a mere 28 years after Columbus makes it to the New World, they're already going around the tip and heading out the other way. You know, something fascinating about Magellan? You know he never made it all the way around.
He was killed in the Philippines.
Killed in the Philippines. So he made it probably better. He made it better than halfway, though.
Yeah, oh, yeah. Very close. Right. I think guy is Elcano.
To me, that's only partial credit.
Completed it. Oh, well.
Come on. Yeah, I mean, they always say, who was the first guy to sail around the world? They say Ferdinand Magellan. Not
true.
That's
true.
He didn't make it.
He was in charge, though.
But not at the end.
As usual, the person in charge gets all the credit.
What about the first mate?
Well, Elcano's, I remember him.
Okay.
I revere that man, too.
You may be one of only one in a million who do. I certainly don't.
I think his ship was the Victoria, wasn't it? I didn't do any notes on him, so.
Yeah, you don't like Magellan?
Not really, no.
Why not?
I don't know.
What's your beef with Magellan?
I like Sir Francis Drake, actually, is my favorite.
Let me take you 100.
My favorite explorer. But the Straits of Magellan, of course, named after him, and some of the nearest galaxies to our own, which we discussed last week, the small and large Magellanic clouds.
Magellanic.
So, hell, I mean, the guy's got galaxies named after him. What do you want?
Mm-hmm. I would have liked him to have been able to finish the trip, but he didn't. Let's take you 140 years up the clock to Gresham College, where Christopher Wren, Robert Boyle, John Wilkins, and Sir Robert Moray decide to found what later becomes known as the Royal Society.
Yeah, that's interesting. I didn't know that. Well, I mean, I've heard of the Royal Society, of course, but I didn't know it was founded today. I don't even know where Gresham College is. Is it in London? Do you know where it is?
See, Marmon, that's what they have a machine called Google.
All right.
Where you
can look
these little facts up.
All right.
In 1811, here's one. Armand, folks, is a music lover. I do think it's important. I don't think this affects the world we live in today greatly, although it's a nice addition. But Beethoven's Piano Concerto No. 5 in E flat major premieres in Leipzig, Germany. I've driven past Leipzig once, and
that's where it'll stay. Yeah, I will dismiss that one, but there was also another piano concerto, Rachmaninoff's Piano Concerto. I believe it debuted in, 1909, I believe. The only reason I think that's important is the Piano Concerto No. 3, if you've seen the movie Shine, remember the David Helfgott story, who's the guy that won the Academy Award? Jeffrey Rush. Jeffrey Rush won the Academy Award for that movie. That piece, and it's a knuckle buster, is what they call it. It's probably the most difficult piano concerto that is routinely played, and a lot of people won't tackle it because it is tough. And my opinion, Helfgott wasn't up to it himself. That's just my opinion.
Are you a pianist?
Yeah, you are. And I'm certainly not in that caliber. But this is a true story. I remember I was listening to radio one day, and somebody was playing the Concerto No. 3, Rachmaninoff. And I thought, you know, there's just something not right about this. This guy is not playing well. And I just didn't know. And they said that was
piano out of tune?
David Helfgott. I don't know. He's just not up to it. I don't know what it was. It's not like he's hitting wrong notes, or I guess maybe he did, but something just didn't sound like the guy had it, you know. And, you know, Half God, of course, had some mental problems, but that's not. But what's, speaking of mental problems, though, Rachmaninoff had a very tough time after his, after the, he's one of my favorite composers, and after the debut of his first symphony, he had a, they really gave it to him pretty tough. And, you know, Glazunov, another Russian composer, was the conductor, and he showed up drunk. And,
well, you can't have that.
Yeah, well, yeah.
You can't have a drunk conductor.
He was drunk at the rehearsals.
What
the
is
guy,
this? Is this Looney Tunes?
Yeah, he was pretty bad.
I mean, Bugs can,
so
know,
it was a disaster.
He can conduct better than that.
Yeah, so Glazunov, right, right. So, yeah, when he's imitating Leopold Stokowski, if I, I think you're, is the, what
Leopold,
you're referring to. Yes.
Leopold.
Right.
Leopold.
At the Hollywood Bowl.
But
anyway, I'm not finished.
Oh, you're not finished. No, we have more Rachmaninoff.
Okay. He had a lot of mental problems. So he went to a kind of composer, half hypnotist psychiatrist, Dr. Dahl. And he straightened him out. And he wrote his second piano concerto and his third, very, you know, I mean, staples of the repertoire right now.
Mm-hmm.
Greatest stuff ever. And he actually dedicated the second piano concerto to Dr. Dahl.
Oh, very good.
He got him over his, quote, writer's block, whatever you want to call it.
All right. So. In 1905, the Irish nationalist Arthur Griffith, he founds Sinn Féin as a political party with the main aim of establishing a monarchy, a dual monarchy, in the Republic of Ireland.
Yeah, don't mess with those guys. We have to have John on this show sometime. We have a lot of Irish history here.
We will. The host of our lineupmedia.fm music show, Celtic Music Lab, and speaking of all things Irish, it doesn't get much more Irish than Celtic Music Lab. Here's one you might enjoy, Irma. 1925, the Grand Ole Opry begins broadcasting in Nashville, Tennessee as the WSM Barn Dance.
Yeah, I would enjoy that as long as I don't have to listen to it.
Mm-hmm. No, you know, you don't like American music.
Not that sort of man.
No, no.
I like Minnie Pearl. How much did her hat cost?
I don't know.
$1.98?
I think $1.98, maybe. Yeah.
Randall, and hey, great. It's not for everyone. I'd rather listen to, you know, Dr. Dahl's concerto.
Well, look at you, you highfalutin.
That's true. I'm an elitist.
Yes, you are. A coastal elite.
I don't partake in that hoi polloi nonsense.
1964, the Mariner program, NASA.
Yeah, that's big, I think.
This is. It's hard to imagine, but 1964, they're not even to the moon, and they're launching stuff at Mars at this point. The Mariner 4 probe is launched and sent out towards Mars.
And I think that's significant because I think that was the first probe to return pictures from
the
deep space.
Planet, yep.
Yeah, of the planet from deep space. So that was, and they were very surprised, I think, because, you know, there's still these, you know, they thought Schiaparelli and the canals, they thought they were going to see cities or something. I don't know what they thought they were going to see, but they were craters. It looked like the moon, and they were rather disappointed.
They had high hopes, and guess what? It looks like the Mojave Desert.
Yeah, but unfortunately, I think they picked a very old part of the planet that hadn't been, you know, whatever.
Well,
I don't know.
Observed by telescope.
I guess the whole planet's old, I guess.
Yeah,
whatever. But apparently, this
looked
more moonish.
It's not like they're building new sections of Mars,
right.
Armand.
Yeah, it's nothing. But something was rather moonish about it, and the rest of the planet really doesn't look that way. So,
in 1971, the assassination of the Prime Minister of Jordan by Black September.
Yeah, those guys didn't mess around.
A unit of the Palestinian Liberation Organization. I bring that up because the PLO, this is one of their first big,
big
acts.
Of course, next year.
The next year, 1972, they go to Munich and they pull
tragic.
Off an even bigger act. And finally, this one, before we get into our major topics of the day, in 1972, I had to look at this repeatedly.
I didn't know this, yeah.
I had to look at this repeatedly because I simply didn't believe it. But the last executions in Paris of Claude Buffet and Roger Bontemps.
I wonder what they did.
They are guillotined at La Santé prison.
Yeah.
La Santé prison. In 1972, the French are still using a guillotine?
Actually, it's a very, I'll tell you what, I think I'd rather go that way than, you know, the injections or firing squad. I mean, that's why a doctor actually invented it. And it's actually a pretty decent way.
You would rather be beheaded.
Absolutely. Oh, then the injections? Oh, yeah, that takes time. You have heart palpitations. It's not even electrocution.
And you don't have heart palpitations on the way to the guillotine?
Well, they probably give you drugs if you want them. Give me a sedative. Put me in the tumbril and roll me up there. Let them knit, you know, like they did in the Revolution. Madame Defarge, let them have fun. It's quicker. It's quicker and cleaner.
You want your head rolling around.
Sure, in a basket. Why not? If you're going to die, who cares? It's quick. You don't know what hits you. Believe me.
You're from the medical profession. What happens or do you die instantly?
Instantly, of course.
Instantly.
You don't live. Yeah.
It's just the lights
That's
go
it.
Out.
Yeah. No, you're painless. You're not sentient after that blade hits. No. Yeah, it is.
Okay.
It's right. Actually a very compassionate way of killing people. That's why the guy came up with it.
Two other notes on this day in history before we get to those big topics. Here's one for you. Just for you, Armand. In 1907, Louis B. Mayer.
Oh, Louis B. Mayer, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Louis B. Mayer. He opens his first movie theater in Haverhill, Massachusetts.
Oh, okay.
And then he goes... And a mere what?
Well, you know,
eight years later, he's making Birth of a Nation.
Did Mayer do? I don't know. Did he? I don't think he did that one. Did he?
Well,
was that Louis B. Mayer?
By 8 to 10 years later, he's making
D.W. Griffith. I don't know if he produced it.
That's right, D.W.
Yeah, I don't think Mayer had anything to do with it. But Louis B. Mayer, yeah, I've heard some interesting. You know, a lot of people think he's the biggest jerk ever. But then, like Joan Crawford called him daddy and stuff like that. And you know, he's supposedly a really nice guy. When you needed help,
Joan Crawford called him daddy.
Yeah, I mean, you know, hey, I'd like Joan Crawford to call me daddy. But you know, he ran a pretty tough outfit there at Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer.
It's production line movies.
You got out of line, you got in trouble. But he seemed like if people needed help or were running into financial difficulty or had problems. He was a guy that was pretty nice guy, apparently.
You're an old Hollywood sort. Mm-hmm. Is he the beginning of the manipulated Hollywood press where the studio feeds the paper the story?
Well, I don't know about that. I don't know what the origin of that was, but he certainly partook in that. You know, because if for instance, if somebody wanted, I believe it was Jeanette McDonald wanted to get married, you know, and he didn't want her to get married because he wanted it to be that Nelson Eddy and she were an item, yes. Things like that. He didn't like stuff like that, you know. He would always
that
cover
potentially
up.
Hurt box office.
Some people were, you know, gay or whatever. He always that was his deal to cover things up, you know, and stuff like that because that's what guys did back then. The big movies, studio moguls, Louis B. Mayer, Sam Goldwyn, Harry Cohn, Daryl F. Zanuck at 20th Century Fox. Now, the guy that really didn't really like him or that he really kind of screwed over was Irving Thalberg, who was the head of production at MGM. And the guy was a great producer. He produced his Night at the Opera. In fact, he made the Marx Brothers. The Marx Brothers were kind of – we love the Marx
we love
Brothers.
Them.
So I'm going to go into some detail on this. After Duck Soup, which didn't really make a hell of a lot of money.
But it's a great movie.
Oh, yeah, of course. So was Horse Feathers. But they weren't making a ton of money, and Paramount kind of kicked the Marx Brothers out. They just didn't renew their contract. Well, Irving Thalberg, and you know, as Chico played cards with everybody in Hollywood because he's you know the worst gambler in the world. So Thalberg took his money, and Thalberg asked him one day, "What are you guys up to?" And he said, "Well, we're between pictures, etc. The usual Hollywood bullshit, you know, for people that are out of work." I'm between pictures, by the way. And,
aren't we all?
Yeah, I think you are too. Yeah. So Thalberg basically said, well, come to MGM and we'll fix you up and everything. And he gave him Night at the Opera, and it was a huge success. And then, you know, but anyway, he was in Europe. He went on a vacation because he was a young guy, and he had a production at like 21.
Wow.
And I think Louis B. Mayer, you know, Louis B. Mayer was, they were related somehow. I don't know how, but anyway, he was Louis B. Mayer's protege. And then when he got back, he went on a vacation for Europe for his heart, came back, and Louis B. Mayer stripped him of all his power. Took him.
Well, at least he has a great Academy Award Lifetime Achievement Award name for him today.
Yes, exactly. The Irving Thalberg Award.
Okay, let's get to some of our big topics for today. But before we do, let me remind you that this day in history is brought to you by Audible.com and by Amazon.com. You can get a free audiobook download and a 30-day free trial at audibletrial.com/thisdayinhistorypodcast. Over 180,000 titles are there for you to choose from. You can use them on your iPhone, your Android, your Kindle, or your MP3 player. And again, we bring up a lot of books on this show. So Audible is where you want to go because when you're out and about traveling this holiday season, nothing better than to slip on a pair of headphones. You don't have to listen to anyone else in the car or on the train or on the plane.
Yeah, it's very convenient.
And you can just enjoy your time and take your time with a great book. All there for you at audible.com. Again, audibletrial.com to get your 30-day free trial and a free audio download. audibletrial.com/thisdayinhistorypodcast. You can also follow us on Facebook at This Day in History Podcast at very simple, facebook.com/thisdayinhistorypodcast, and our website, same, thisdayinhistorypodcast.com.
Can I make one more point about Rachmaninoff? Something
oh
very
goodness.
Obscure. Let
oh
me ask you a question. What disease do they think Lincoln had? Do you remember this?
It's wasting disease. So what was the clinical term?
Marfan syndrome.
Syndrome.
That's what made him tall and kind of gangly, and he had a lot of stenosis and stuff like that, spinal scoliosis. They think Rachmaninoff also had that, but on the positive side, he had huge hands, which is what they're called arachnodactyly, which is spider fingers. And old spider fingers could make some of his pieces were so hard to play.
He can play some chords, he can reach an octave like nine notes,
you know, so that makes it a little tough, especially for the ladies.
That's a little hard to read. But they think
he might have had Marfan's.
All right, let's go to 1814. This, to me, is a huge one. It affects the world we live in today to this very day.
Well, you're going to have to, I'm going to walk you through this.
In London, England, the Times newspaper is for the first time printed by automatic steam-powered presses built by German inventors Koenig and Friedrich Bauer. And this signals what becomes the start of the availability, the widespread dissemination of newspapers to a mass audience. Mm-hmm. Books and the printing press had been around, but that didn't mean that books were ubiquitous. In fact, books were rare. But now a newspaper, a daily newspaper, could truly reach the masses starting at this date in 1814. An informed public becomes an informed electorate.
Yes, but was it a conservative newspaper? That would have been truly momentous.
Don't make me admonish you.
Yes.
Okay. Well, first of all, there are newspapers aren't.
Well, we were
together
all Saturday night playing trivia, and we didn't even have any arguments. So I'd like to start one.
Well, we
now.
Can have one now.
Good.
Now, newspapers is certainly the American Revolution. There's plenty of newspapers in the American Revolution.
I didn't know anything about this, by the way.
But I'm talking about, you know, now you have the boy in the street, you know, hawking a headline. This, to me, is monumentous that everybody and newspapers don't become pass along.
I'm just wondering, you can
grab your own now because the cost has gone so far down.
I'm thinking more, though, of the practicality. Why is steam-powered pressing? I mean, what did they use before? That, to me, seems revolutionary here. Steam power? What did they use before? What power?
Manpower.
Well, they just cranked it or whatever. Why?
Set your type.
I remember those old movies in the West, right? And they just cranked the
broadsheet.
Okay.
But steam power. Now, I mean,
it still took a long time to set the type and all that, though. Why would it be so much faster?
And it did 100 years. It's not the fastness of it. It's the amount of material you can process.
I'm going to look into it. I don't know. That just doesn't seem so momentous to me. Like typeset, I can see that's a big deal.
Certainly, it's a big deal.
Cut down the time, but steam-powered presses. I'm not sure how. I don't know. I'd like to see just how much faster or how much more efficient
think in terms
it was.
Think in terms of output.
Okay. Well, you're saying
newspapers, yeah. Used to be tagged or nailed up to public places.
Well, that was way back,
right?
Yeah.
Okay, so you go and stand in line and read.
Right.
So
yeah, public proclamation and things like that.
Exactly.
I mean, you had heralds and stuff.
But. Or you go to a tavern and a newspaper or a public house and a newspaper is there and passed around, much like it is today if you walk into a coffee shop, right?
Okay.
But the difference is
you
can now take that newspaper to your job, home.
But the point you're making is you could turn out a whole ton of these things much faster.
So your
daily circulation could
be exponentially increased. And look at the knock-on
effects. All right, I'm going to check on that.
Okay. Advertising, hence, grows from that point of time, which means consumerism grows. And keep it your...
Do we want that?
Well, I don't know if you want it or not.
I do. I don't buy you.
But you are just before the Industrial Revolution is really going to kick into high gear at this point. So a mechanism
is more important than I thought.
A mechanism to sell your wares is now there. Because before then, it's what?
Yeah, but like anything else, I don't know if that probably coincided with this. Like anything else, it probably took a while for the advertisers to catch on. You know, like radio.
Radio,
they didn't know what to do with it. When it came out, they thought it was public service.
Yeah, basically.
It's like for free. What the hell are we doing with this? How are we going to monetize it?
Right.
And then somebody took a while for somebody to say, hey, we can advertise on this.
So all that happened.
Okay, well, I'm going to look that
up. In 1814. In 1893, this one is dear to your heart, Armand, New Zealand.
I don't know why you think I'm such a misogynist. I don't have any problem with women voting.
Okay, well, New Zealand.
This is the second slur today.
New Zealand becomes the first country in which women vote in a national election.
That's true.
The first country.
No problem.
New Zealand, 1893.
Right.
You're good with that.
Yeah, absolutely.
Here's why I think it changes how we live today.
Okay.
It changed politics from that second
forward. Since 1920 here, the 1920 election is won.
Since suffrage was accomplished here in the United States.
Yeah.
OK, Okay, 19.
Oh, definitely changed 20. A lot of things. England, too, in England.
Right,
huh?
The whole political landscape of the world and how government and how elected officials.
I'll go farther than that.
Go
just to show you.
And get a message to a voter, appeal to an electorate. I mean, it changes radically at this point.
Well, I know,
opinion.
But and the shock was, at least in this last election, that Trump carried, what, 42% of the female vote or something like that?
I've seen among
that's
some.
That's why he won. There's no doubt about that.
Some demographics that he was at 50.
Okay. I'm sure that astounded a lot of people. But I'm going to go farther than that. And
go
I will
farther.
Say now, I'll bet you there are more. I don't know. I mean, I'm just going. I think there are more women in medical school now, or at least I think there are. I think there are more women in college as a percentage.
Mm-hmm.
I think women these days they achieve more than men. I'm sorry to say. I regret it. Because, like, my friends are teaching college.
Mm-hmm.
To a man, they say their women, their girl students are
they're
smarter.
Female students.
Yes, girl. Female.
Female.
Yes. XX students. XX chromosome students. Not the XYs. They do better, and they're just more conscientious, and they're harder working. And I hate to say that, but I think that's the way it is. The trend is. I don't have a problem with that. The problem is I think men are getting lazy. Women are taking up the slack. Well, come on, men. Get your shit together. Be at least equal. I'm going to clarify.
No,
I think women are equal in every way.
In my whole lifetime, the smartest people I have known or the smartest people who have always been next to me in a class have been female.
I resent that.
No, in a class. We've never been in a class together.
Right. That's
but
true.
Whether it
I'm
be
in a
grade school,
above.
Middle school, high school, and
okay.
college.
Yeah, I know.
You know, not that they're, but per capita.
I say that too, and spelling bees and things like that. I was always, when I was like at home, you know how competitive
there
I am.
There you go.
I always want to be a top smite, but my competition was always a woman. I didn't really have any problem with the guys. There were always two or three girls in my class.
Absolutely.
I hope I can beat her because she is bright.
Absolutely. If there was a curve buster in some of my classes in college, whether it be economics or you know, advanced financial investment,
I agree.
It was always a female student who was just almost savant-like at their...
Well, then do you agree with me on the general decline of the American male?
I don't know if it's the decline of the American male. I think it's the ascent of the American woman post-World War II.
I think there's some of each.
I really do. My grandmothers fall into this category. One was a non-worker, but she was incredibly smart and very literate. The other, my father's mother, was a worker. She was a high school graduate prior to World War II. Very few women graduated high school prior to World War II. She also went to a secondary school after that, a business school. She became the administrative assistant to the president of a chemical company.
Okay. Well,
so, you know, and she's a full-time working woman in the early 1950s. Those are few and far between. But those trendsetters did set a big trend, and the educational system in our country, which, you know, is open to all, and...
But it was axiomatic back then if a woman did go to college or some sort of advanced school, it was to meet a husband.
Again, that's what they say, but come on.
You know, but it by and large, I mean, obviously, there are no. I'm not making a categorical statement, but that was, you know, that was why they went to school.
I do not believe that all women.
Not all, of course not.
I don't even believe a large degree of women bothered to go to college to get an MRS degree.
Well, I think back then, not anymore. I mean, I'm talking about the 50s.
I don't even know in the 50s.
Okay, well, it's an interesting subject. Well, since we're on that subject, I think our next...
Well...
I think that kind of segues well into your next one you have circled.
I have 1895 circled.
Oh, okay.
Is that what you're looking at?
No,
or do you
have...
Let's skip ahead one.
Yes.
Let's stay on this topic. In 1919, London, England, Lady Astor is elected as a member of the Parliament of the United Kingdom, and she becomes the first woman to sit in the House of Commons. There had been a previous... female elected. There had been a previous woman elected.
She didn't serve, though, I don't think.
But she refused to sit.
By the way, do you know who the first woman Speaker of the House of Commons was? There's only been one. A little trivia question for you.
No, I do not.
Betty Boothroyd.
Betty Boothroyd.
And she's still around, I think. It was in the 90s.
Have you ever been to the House of Commons?
Yeah, I've seen Parliament.
Okay, so,
sure.
I just did that tour for the first time this past summer.
I didn't go in. I saw it, you know. I didn't get to go in.
You didn't go in the chamber?
No.
Okay. If you saw it, you saw it. Being on the
How many members?
Oh, you got me.
660.
660.
Right.
In Commons.
House of Commons,
correct. So I highly recommend the Parliament tour in in London,
okay,
right in Westminster, technically, because I'd never done it. All my trips there, never bothered.
The building was designed by Charles Barry, by the way, the Houses of Parliament.
And
hell of a building.
The tour is remarkable. They have the audio thing that you put on the headset.
When did you take this tour?
July of this year.
Oh, geez. And so it must be fresh in your memory.
Yeah, July of 2016. And my daughter wanted to do it. Her friend wanted to do it. My mother wanted to do it. I said, oh, you know what?
Did you pay for that?
Yeah, and it was cheap. Okay. You know? Okay. But it was great. It was absolutely great. And you get to go into, you know, you're in House of Lords. You're in the House of Commons. The only thing that they do is ask you not to sit down. Oh. But you know, you can stand right where the prime minister is, and he's got the box, you know, that he puts his notes on top of.
Yeah, and then the speaker, doesn't he? What does he have, that scepter, whatever the hell that's called?
And it's a fabulous tour. But you know,
Lady Astor is one of my favorites. Nancy Langhorn, she was born in Virginia, American woman. Actually, Danville, Virginia, which the significance of that.
Danville, Virginia.
Little trivia question.
Oh, why am I blanking?
Last capital of the Confederacy.
Capital. After they moved it from Richmond.
Yeah, they moved it to Danville. Okay. Danville. She was born there into a rather aristocratic family. I forget what her first husband's name was. That was kind of an outrage, too, that she was divorced.
Yes.
Lady Astor. But the interesting thing about her, some of her quotes, my favorite one, for instance, I married beneath me. All women do. Isn't that great? That's a great quote.
That's a fabulous one. Yes. And it's true.
And here's another good one. The only thing I like about rich people is their money. I mean, she had... Now, of course, she had some rather... She and Churchill didn't get along very well. And they had some rather... Now, some of these might have been apocryphal, but...
Yeah, but
they're
so good.
The one that you always hear, you know, Lady Astor... She said, Mr. Churchill, if you were my husband, I would poison your tea. And Churchill said, Lady Astor, if you're my wife, I'd drink it. And then she says, and then Churchill apparently was wondering what to go to a masquerade party dressed as, and she says, why don't you just show up sober, Prime Minister? You know, so the other one was when she did get elected to the House of Commons, Churchill said something like, it's rather like having a woman burst into you, intrude on you while you're in the bathroom, and she said, you're not handsome enough to have to worry about that.
Coming from a guy who did a lot of his work in the tub.
Apparently, yeah. But they had quite a running battle between them, yeah.
That is good stuff. All right, that's the date, November 28th, 1919. All right, let's have some birthdays, Armand, before we get back to the big topics. Birthdays on this date.
Yeah, I added a couple.
You added a couple.
Okay, you go ahead with yours.
Let me go with 1757, William Blake, the English poet and painter.
Yeah, he was a little prissy for me.
I thought he might not be your cup of tea. But I like his etchings.
Yeah.
1866, Henry Bacon. Who is Henry Bacon, you might ask? Well, he's the architect for the Lincoln Memorial.
Yeah, you got me on that one. I should have known that.
So
I didn't know
the
that.
Greek Renaissance, I believe that's the correct term, Greek Renaissance art.
Has that kind of influence, looks like.
Yeah, much of the influence on Washington, D.C., but the Lincoln Memorial.
Now, did he do the statue of him? Because that was somebody else.
I believe the statue.
French? Was that Daniel Chester French?
Look it up.
I don't want to
bore
people.
You ask all these questions. Look it up. Barry Gordy is born on this date in 1929.
Don't really care. Is he still alive? He's not alive, is he?
Yeah.
He is?
Yeah.
Wow.
The American songwriter and producer, the founder of Motown Records.
Okay, well, that's pretty big, yeah. He got to give him his due.
In my opinion, he never really aged.
Oh, God, he's 87. He's doing pretty well.
He doesn't look 87, I'll tell you that.
Here's a guy that aged. I think
Gary Hart.
Yeah, if you're going to say it. He aged quite a bit in a few days back in 88.
Here's the American lawyer and politician who was sincerely on his way to being a presidential nominee.
Sure looked like he had a good – but you know that's something interesting. 1984, I believe, was the last time the primaries went to the convention without being – you know, where they actually went to the convention.
Yeah.
You know, because now it's already decided.
Right.
But for 84, it wasn't.
And Mondale was selected at the convention.
Yeah, first ballot. But Hart was still in there.
Mm.
So that was the last time that happened.
And that did change the course of American history. His little dalliance that got
monkey
publicized.
Business, right.
That was the name of the boat.
Name of the Marx Brothers movie, too.
And yeah, it was.
Donna Rice. Nice dish. Good look. I like that dish.
That was a good, you know what? Women involved in scandal back then.
There was Fawn Hall, Donna Rice, and the other one. Who was the
The one for
Jessica Hahn.
Well, that was with the preacher, yes.
Yeah, she was pretty good looking, too.
She was very good looking. She wound up in Playboy armor.
Yeah, I remember that.
This one is for the...
I don't know who the hell you
Well,
pick
I'm going to tell you why.
Yeah,
this one is for the ladies. Okay. Any women listening, I will just say this name. On this date, one of the things that you... If you
See,
got
now, this may be a sexist comment.
No.
Okay.
No.
This is
Sex and the City. It's not sexist. But the great shoe designer Manolo Blahnik is
born. He brought up quite a bit in that show?
Sex and the City?
Yeah.
All the time.
Oh, so that's just like a status symbol to have
it
a Blahnik shoe?
It is a complete status symbol to have
Never
a Manolo Blahnik. Yep.
Okay.
Well, you wouldn't. You don't wear high heels.
I don't watch the show. I mean, I didn't even know they brought him up.
I don't know. But,
okay. Yeah. Wait, listen. I treat people. That is my business.
Yeah. Well, you should be aware. You should say.
As a podiatrist, I cannot endorse that.
Do you not? You should not be endorsing Manolo Blahnik. 1943, the singer and composer, the pianist, Randy Newman is born.
Okay.
And followed in 1949, the same date, Paul Schaefer. Here's one of my favorites, 1950, Ed Harris.
I liked him in...
fantastic actor.
He was good in Pollock. I thought that was...
I thought he nailed Pollock. I loved him in The Right Stuff. Currently, I'm watching him in Westworld
on HBO. I've only seen the first episode. I got to catch up on that. He's not a nice guy, is he?
No. He's able to play all sorts of different characters. I mean, again, here's one. His turn in Glengarry Glen Ross, supporting role.
Right. Yeah, he was in that.
Dynamite.
Well, I'll tell you, I still like the speech by Alec Baldwin at the beginning. Of course,
ABC.
That was written for the, it wasn't in the play. That was written for the movie.
That's a Mamet.
Yeah.
Right, David? Mamet? Mm-hmm. Okay. 1959, Judd Nelson is born. 1961, this is a very good director. And I think he's
an Academy Award winner.
Alfonso Cuarón.
I think he won for Gravity, didn't he?
Yes. And in 1962, the comedian, the actor, the television host, Armand does not like this man.
He has no gravity.
John Stewart is born. And
he levitates.
You also wanted to add
very
in.
Very light.
Henry Hazlitt was born on this date.
Now we have a man with some gravitas. My favorite. And listen, let me tell you something. If you want to do yourself a favor, this is what you should do immediately. Read Economics in One Lesson by Henry Hazlitt.
Well,
unbelievable. Brilliant man.
Actually,
brilliant man.
Let me check something out here.
1894. It's got to be on Amazon, and it must be on our... It should be. It has to.
I am checking. It definitely will be on Amazon.
Economics in One Lesson by Henry Hazlitt.
Da, 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 da.
I'm surprised you didn't bring up Mr. Engels, Frederick Engels, 1820.
I did not.
Yeah,
unfortunately, it's not available as an audiobook.
Okay, I know it's on Amazon.
But if you go to Amazon.com, what you do is you go to our website, thisdayinhistorypodcast.com. You look for the Amazon banner. You click on the Amazon banner, and you start to go shopping.
Yeah, and I got a couple other ones, too.
Very simple. You also had Gloria Graham.
Gloria Graham. And the only reason I bring this up is, most people probably know her, and it's getting to be that season. It's not the one that won. She won the Academy Award for A Bad and the Beautiful. But her probably most famous role was Violet Bick in...
Violet Bick.
Yeah.
Violet Bick. Yeah, you just got me. I'm stumped.
That's some dress you're wearing there, Violet. Let's go up to the lake and we can swim in it.
And Jimmy Stewart movie?
Jimmy Stewart. I'm glad my imitation. Yeah. Yeah, it was from It's a Wonderful Life.
Oh.
Gave her $20. You know, she's going to New York. Georgie gave him a kiss and all that. And that was Violet. That was Gloria Graham.
Okay.
Anyway, the interesting Gloria Graham married the director Nicholas Ray, whose probably his most famous movie was probably Rebel Without a Cause. Mm-hmm. He directed that, and I believe it was the Humphrey Bogart movie. Anyway, Dead Reckoning, I think it was. No, In a Lonely Place. He directed that.
Okay.
Anyway, she married him.
Okay.
Well, Nick came home one night, and lo and behold, Gloria's in bed with Nick's 13-year-old son. Her stepson.
Really? She's birds and bee in him, huh?
Yeah. And they got a divorce forthwith, and a few years later, she married the son. So that's
really?
Yeah. And poor Gloria, just another blotch on my profession. Gloria had cancer, and they were doing a pretty good job of getting rid of it, breast cancer. I think it went into remission. Although
so your profession is what?
Medicine. And she went into remission more or less, and she had some edema, some fluid in her abdomen. They did a surgery on her to get rid of it, and the schmuck cut her bowel and gave her peritonitis, and she died. So 57 years old.
Is that Dr. Schmuck?
Yeah, it was a doctor. It was an Italian doctor, though. She was in Italy, so the AMA is not responsible for that.
And now you'll probably blame socialized medicine next.
I'm surprised you missed we'll have a whole show on that sometime, but here's one I'm surprised you missed. Ernst Röhm. Come on.
Come on.
Yeah.
Ernst Röhm.
Yeah.
Inform me.
Oh, come on. You don't know who Ernst Röhm is?
No.
He's the head of the SA. Hitler's, you know, before the SS.
They had the SA.
The brown shirts. Ernst Röhm. Uh-huh. Ernst was Hitler's one. In fact, he was the last guy. Believe me, he was the last guy.
He's not the guy who shot in Munich that they would do the annual presentation for, was he?
No, he was okay. He was killed. Let's see, he was killed a long time before that, before Munich. Well, I mean, he was in the beer hall putsch.
Yes,
that, okay, he was there. Sure,
he was one of the okay.
Yeah, he was with Hitler, and he was the last one to really call him Adolf for 80. You know, in his presence, so
really?
They were that close. In fact, yeah, but the
now,
problem was
now is he one of the guys that Hitler stood behind during the encounter because he was afraid.
At the putsch?
Yeah.
Oh, I'm sure, because he was a badass. He was the enforcement arm, the SA.
Ah.
And, in fact, I think, what is it? A storm battalion. That's what it is. It was in German. I can't pronounce it. But the storm battalion is what they were. And they were the guys, you know, they were against, they were the ones that fought on the streets against the communists, backed up the workers or not, whatever. But anyway, they got so out of hand that Hindenburg was the president and Hitler was chancellor.
Yes.
And these guys were getting so crazy. And there were a lot of boozers. And they were all gay, by the way, all of them, in fact, including Röhm. And that's where the notion that Hitler might have been LGBT.
Really?
Because he and Röhm may have been like that. Because he was very reluctant to have this guy bumped off. And the people, the head of the Minister of Defense and Hindenburg was getting a little old. And they knew Hitler was going to take over. They said, listen, you're not taking over with these guys running amok in the streets and drinking and you know, buggering people. So
there's a word you don't hear enough
yes,
of.
In the 30s you did. Well, if you're in the SA, you heard it all the time.
Usually one has to go to a private boys' school
in
upstate New England or New York to hear the term buggery.
Clipper ship or something. But, yeah, and anyway, they said, Rome's got to go. And the SA, and you've heard of the Night of the Long Knives?
Line of the Long
that
Knives.
That was what they did. They took care of the biggies, and Röhm got killed. They shot him in the chest.
Back to our three big—
and he was born in, well, 1887.
1887.
That's
why I made him up.
Yeah.
Ernst Röhm.
R-O-H-M. I probably Röhm, because there's an umlaut over it.
There is an umlaut.
So would that be Röhm?
You got me.
Okay.
My German is no good.
Okay.
Big topics we have left today on this day in history, 1943, the Tehran Conference.
Oh, we're
I always felt, I always
well,
felt
I think,
bad.
Didn't we? But I think we skipped your—
Oh, we
didn't
did.
Didn't you have—
we
Yeah,
skipped
I don't
one.
Want
Let
you
me
to
go
skip
back.
Your—
1895. Yeah, okay. Now, Armon will argue that this is not big.
It's
I say this
insignificant.
Is monumental. No,
please.
The In 1895, November 28th, the first American automobile race takes place. And it takes place in Chicago,
yeah.
Up to Evanston.
My favorite town.
And back down to Chicago. 54 miles in total. Frank Duryea wins in approximately 10 hours.
About with 5.4 miles.
A whopping
an
average
hour.
Speed, I think, of about 7.5.
Wow. Oh, because I must have taken a couple of breaks, huh?
Well, I mean, certainly they probably had to replace tires,
okay, yeah,
mechanic things. But this is the first, and it's in 1895. Six cars entered this race officially.
Yeah.
And they had to postpone it many times before they could get, you know, the permission to basically race up the streets of Chicago and up to Evanston, turn around and come back. The roads are non-existent. You know, they're horse and buggy trails. That's all
I
they
would
are.
Think,
at
yeah,
this
just
point.
Dirt roads or whatever.
But the reason I think this is so important is because of the innovation that racing brings and has brought to all of us.
Okay, so that's why you bring this
it's
up.
It's hugely important. The old
seemingly
ad.
Seemingly completely.
The, well, a lot of people, a lot
trivial.
Of people, yes, they will always scoff at auto racing.
I am. I'm scoffing.
And they'll say, well, that's just cars going around in circles. And my answer to that is always, well, yeah, that's the point. If they didn't go around in circles, it'd be really stupid of you to attend the race.
Well, you have a point there. Same could be said for horses, I guess.
Well, at least they go in a circle.
Okay.
And they
I'll
come
circle
back.
It. I'm circling it. I actually
so
crossed
the,
it out.
The innovation that occurs, though, as a result, and the old adage is, you know, people would say, when was the first auto race? And the answer—
That's a good trivia question. I didn't know that.
The answer, you know, the sort of urban legend answer is, well, the first auto race is the day that they finished the second car.
Well, I guess that's—
Because it's natural for people to want to race each other.
Oh, okay.
In any means.
Well,
it always has been.
The second teenager got a car.
No.
Don't race.
Now, in this event, in 1895, three of the cars were Benzes.
Oh,
this
okay.
is pre-merger even. This, you know, so three
Daimler,
of the cars were
Daimler
Benzes,
Benz, yeah.
And one of the cars was even battery powered, purely electric. But it ran out of juice.
Any steam cars?
I don't know if they had a steamer in it or not, although the Stanley steamer is well regarded as one of the fastest vehicles of the, of that
age. At that time,
Perhaps probably the fastest if you absolutely opened the thing up. But racing, and because racing becomes an American staple.
Yeah.
And as Hemingway said, there are only three sports, Armand.
I didn't know Hemingway said that.
There are only three. There's bullfighting.
Right.
There's boxing. And there's auto racing.
Did he say that?
Yes.
Well, I know he said.
And the reason is because something is at stake in each of that, each of the of those things. And what's at stake is your life.
Well, that's true. I mean, he also said, you know, to be a man, you have to plant a tree, write a book, fight a bull.
Fight a bull. Well, he loved the bulls,
man. Oh,
baby.
Man, I haven't done any of this stuff.
Well, get to it.
Well, I'm writing a book. Yeah, well,
there you go.
Okay. What was the other? He had a couple other
but
ones.
But innovation out of auto racing brought us better vehicles. Brought us a better quality of life. It brought us standardization. It brought us the assembly line, which brings us a 40-hour work week. I mean, the knock-on effect.
I don't know if the environmentalists would agree with you on this.
I'm not too concerned about the environmentalist at this point.
All right.
I'm just saying the knock-on effect is huge. I mean, yes, it did bring about the combustion.
I didn't know the implications of this.
I mean, the implications just
momentous.
And it brought away about a way to sell cars, which drove industry. And Chicago was trying to become an automotive leader already at this point. And as history would show you, Detroit became number one. Eventually, St. Louis, Missouri would wind up as number two. But Chicago and Indianapolis were also always a close.
As far as production.
Yeah.
Okay.
And so were places like Cleveland and the greater Cleveland area. So, you know, for the Midwest, you know, this was big.
All right.
And that is why to this day, racing, particularly short track racing and other forms of racing, are so popular in the Midwest. They originated next to the factories where the cars were built.
Well, that makes sense.
Whether it's motorcycle with Harley Davidson in Milwaukee, or whether it's, you know, any number of manufacturers that were in Michigan, Indiana, Ohio, and Illinois.
All right. Well, in the hierarchy, I'm going to have to put it behind the Mariner program, but I'll put it ahead of the Grand Ole Opry. It'll make you happy as far as significance.
Significance?
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Let's go back to the conference in Tehran. The
Tehran
Conference, 1943. Three of your favorite people. You do not like Franklin Roosevelt.
No.
You don't really like Churchill.
Not really.
And I think you probably love Stalin.
No.
I
don't like him either.
No? Okay. So three people you don't like. They all meet up in Tehran. My question is, during the middle of World War II, they all had to venture to Persia? They had to venture to Iran to have this conference?
Yeah, I'm not sure how that was arranged.
And the other one was in Yalta. The other big one.
Well, that was, but that was Russia, obviously.
I know, but, I mean, Stalin couldn't travel?
Well, Stalin didn't think Stalin didn't think he had to travel, and he insisted, I think, that they came to him. But things that are more, have you ever heard of Operation Long Jump?
I don't believe
so. Now, this may be, here again, this I think this was what the Russians concocted this, and it's never really been proven that this happened. But somehow, Hitler, supposedly, they broke the U.S. Naval Code, and they knew that the big three were going to meet at Tehran, okay, for the conference. Supposedly, Otto Skorzeny, which will, you know, when he has his birthday, we'll go into detail on this guy, because he was some badass. I mean, this guy had a pair of balls on him like two neutron stars, which we'll talk about later.
Okay.
Anyway, they sent him the Operation Long Jump to assassinate the big three.
Okay.
And apparently the Russians, NKVD, which was a predecessor to the
KGB.
KGB, squelched it through their spies and caught the other and squelched it before he even got off the ground.
Yeah.
Apparently the Russians made all that up just to make it look like the NKVD
did something.
This. But they called it Operation Long Jump, supposedly. And they were going to assassinate all three of them.
What's the biggest thing that came out of the Tehran conference?
Well, Roosevelt giving in to Stalin, as usual. you know, and well, they probably the biggest, you know, and here's the thing. Stalin said, after we win this war, I want to execute 50 to 100,000 German officers. Just execute them because I don't want this happening again. And then, as a joke, this is Franklin Roosevelt's humor. Well, would it be all right if we just did 49,000? And then Churchill got so pissed off, he got up and walked out. Until Stalin said, "Wait, well, we're just joking," you know. Yeah, as if Stalin, you know, is doing a stand-up act.
He's certainly known for a sense of humor.
Yeah, that risible Georgian, Joseph Stalin, He's damn, you know, he's damn serious. And Rose, and so was Roosevelt, I believe.
Okay,
so, Churchill wouldn't stand for it.
You know, you always see the picture of the three of them. You know, they're sitting in their chairs and everything. What I didn't know until I really looked into this was it was at the Soviet embassy in Tehran.
Yeah.
So they're not even really on neutral ground.
No, technically they're on Russian soil, I guess. Yeah, you'd say. And, but like I said, I think Stalin made them come to him. He was, you know, he had just won the Battle of Kursk. And he did have a point. I mean, 90% of the German army was fighting on the Eastern Front. And he was, hey, get you guys, get your act together and get on the German, you know, he wanted to open a second front up. Well, Churchill said, well, let's attack Italy first, which is what they were doing. At the time, they were in Sicily, I believe. They had invaded Sicily, moving to Italy. But Stalin was kind of getting antsy because he wanted another front. And Italy wasn't cutting it for him. In fact, now that we've mentioned Lady Astor, I believe she got in a little trouble at this time because she called people fought in Italy D-Day Dodgers, D-Day Draft Dodgers. Mm. So kind of demeaning people who didn't fight. That she was pretty rough with her. She had quite a tongue, a Serbic tongue.
So you are not a fan of FDR.
No.
Is it the willingness or the agreement to give the Eastern Bloc to...
Yeah, Stalin had... You know, FDR, if you read, I've read several books about him at Yalta, him at not Tehran so much, but Yalta was a big one where he gave away half of Europe. He was much more concerned with the British retaining their empire. You know, he wanted more concessions from Churchill than he wanted from Stalin. You know, free elections in India and getting rid of Burma and all this. He wanted to dismantle the British. And... I mean, not that that was a bad thing or good thing, but he was more worried about the British Empire than the damn Russians. And I'll give him a break a little bit because he was dying. He should never run for the fourth term anyway. When he has his birthday April 12th was the day he died, so whatever comes first, go into detail.
The fourth term, does he defeat Dewey or Wendell Willkie?
Thomas Dewey.
Yeah. And he defeats Willkie in 1940.
40, correct.
Okay.
But at this particular, here again, he gave into all the concessions. Stalin wanted them to attack. He said, okay, so they made a promise. We will attack. We will launch D-Day May 1944.
Yeah.
Obviously, we went a little bit farther than that.
Sure, yeah, June 6th.
June 6th. But other than that, I think they basically, I don't remember what else was discussed. I think they discussed like Turkey and Iran, and they want to get Turkey in the war on their side, of course, trying to do that. I think it was before this, or I think it was before or after, they actually had the Cairo conference, which isn't quite as big because the other big three, Stalin wasn't there, but Chiang Kai-shek was there. It was Churchill, Roosevelt, and Chiang Kai-shek, and they discussed. We'll go into that one. But
the
same trip.
The reason that this one affects the world we live in today is because. Can you put this as day one of the Cold War?
I'd say Yalta probably.
Okay.
I mean, Churchill had his doubts about Stalin. You know, I mean, he really did. Here again, I'm reading another book now. This one I think would probably be. I'm sure it's on Amazon. Check and see if it's on Audible. Churchill, Roosevelt, and the Unnecessary War. By Patrick Buchanan. Great stuff. Great book.
Patrick Buchanan.
Yeah. Patrick J. Buchanan, I believe. Because there's a Patrick Buchanan who's an economist, too.
Yeah, here we have it. You can find it right at audible.com. Simply type in Churchill, Hitler, and the Unnecessary War by the author Patrick J. Buchanan, narrated by Don
I'm
Leslie.
I'm just about finished with it.
And you can do this as a free audio download. And you can get your 30-day free trial. Audibletrial.
Highly recommended.
.com/thisdayinhistorypodcast. And you can choose that one to go with. Okay, two more before we wrap things up and conclude with our deaths. You are a science freak, aren't you?
Oh, yeah, I had to put this one
on
in
this
there.
Date in 1967, the first pulsar known as PSR B1919+21 in the constellation of Vulpecula was discovered by two astronomers, Jocelyn Bell Burnell and Antony Hewish.
Yes, and pulsars are rapidly spinning neutron stars. A neutron star, are you familiar with stellar evolution?
No, I'm not.
All right. Basically, what happens is a star accretes enough material in the accretion disk, dust and other, start spinning, accreting. When you get enough mass, you start to get nuclear chain reaction.
Yeah.
Okay, it's just from the intense heat.
Is this fission or fusion?
Fusion reaction.
Fusion.
Yeah, in the core of stars, like our star, the sun. Anyway, well, what happens is, for depending on how big the star is, our sun will probably shine. It's already been shining for about 5 billion years. It'll probably be another 5 billion. But when this, when these nuclear chain reactions, they start, basically what they do is they use hydrogen, fuse hydrogen into helium, four hydrogen into one helium atom. This gives off a tremendous amount of energy. It also takes a lot of mass. Well, for billions of years, this happens. Now, this, of course, pushes out. You can imagine all these nuclear bombs going off. You can see it pushing out all the mass of the sun. Well, gravity, the sun's immense size, the gravity itself is pushing in.
Yes.
And for all these billions of years, now a bigger star doesn't last, maybe a few hundred million years. These two forces offset each other, and you have relative stability. Okay. Well, when a star has used all its internal, it goes from hydrogen to helium, and then it fuses helium, I believe, into oxygen. Then I think oxygen goes to carbon, and then it goes to iron. And once it starts using iron as its fuel, it only lasts a few seconds, and that's it. It stops. Now what happens
is— But when you say it stops, is that a supernova occurring, or
chain reaction stops. That's it, because for whatever reason, iron does not blow up. It does not. You know, once it starts using that as a fuel, it's over. So the nuclear chain reaction stops, and the intense gravity that's pushing in takes over.
Okay.
Now, if you got a star the size of the sun and this gravity pushes in, you basically get a white dwarf. It goes down to that size. You know, it's not that much gravity, and it just turns into like a burnout, like a little white dwarf, which is like a burnout star, like mm-hmm. a match that's gone off and it still has some embers left.
Yeah, like a smoldering ember.
Kind of. Yeah, that's a good analogy. Ashes, et cetera. If it's, I believe that there's called a Chandrasekhar limit, named after Rubramanan Chandrasekhar, Indian astrophysicist. If it's from 8 to 15 solar masses, the gravity is so intense, it keeps pushing in till you get to the point what they call electron degeneracy, or I think it's nuclear degeneracy, quark degeneracy. Degeneracy basically being an electron's negatively, you know the structure of the atom.
Yes.
You've got the nucleus, protons and neutrons.
Trons.
The electrons.
With orbiting electrons.
Correct, in a cloud around, yes. around the nucleus. This pushes those together so far that the electrons and the protons merge into neutrons. So now all you have is neutrons, because the negative and the positive push. Because basically the
atom. He's very excited about this.
Yeah, that really gets me off. I love this stuff. So if you take an atom, it's like I think they say it's like a marble or even less in a football field. And the football field, the stadium, that's the electron. That's how much empty space there is. Right. That empty space is crushed by tremendous gravity. So now all you have are neutrons.
Okay.
And when it does this, the damn thing spins like crazy.
Okay.
Okay, so it spins. And it's actually, the spin is so regular, and that's how they found these things. They're so regular, they're actually more accurate than an atomic clock. Because they spin.
It's like the universe is atomic.
Hundreds of thousands of times a second. Yeah, and you can. Yeah, they're more right. So they're that's how accurate they are. And basically, what happens is a pulsar, when the thing is spinning around that fast, and then it's, say there's some kind of star close to it, it's sucking in all the debris from the other star, and as this stuff goes in and shoots out, we see that when it shoots out in our direction, it's basically electromagnetic energy that we can detect. And it's called a pulsar. It's pulsing, literally.
So it's not a supernova.
Well, it's the remnants of a supernova.
It's a remnant, okay.
Yeah, the remnants is what started. A neutron star is a remnant, burnout remnant. Now, if it goes even farther, and that's 1815 solar masses. If the star's bigger than that, you've got so much crushing force from that gravity.
You get a black hole.
You overcome the degeneracy, electron degeneracy, and you get a black hole. And we'll go into that sometime. But actually, they just found proof of gravitational waves, which Einstein had a theory over 100 years ago of gravitational waves, because they had two neutron stars, binary neutron or pulsars,
okay.
And the LIGO, which I believe is Large Interferometer Gravitational Observatory. I think that's what it's called.
So were they?
They detected gravitational waves come from these two pulsars that were I don't know. The gravity is so intense. They're actually like ripples in gravity.
Explain this to me, though. Is this a wave that is just traveling?
I guess some kind of rip. It's like a ripple in gravity, supposedly.
Okay, but is
way
this,
beyond my.
Is this a wave that's traveling through the air, like we would encounter a microwave or a radio?
I don't think it's electromagnetic. That's electromagnetic radiation.
Right. Or is this actual gravity. Bending of space-time and warping of space-time itself?
This is actually some sort of bending of gravity, or yeah, but maybe it is the actual space-time whatever that material, you know, the actual bending of space-time, I guess you would say. I'll have to look it up.
So it's warping of the, basically the fabric of our universe.
Yeah, gravitational waves.
And that all happened on this day?
Well, not all that, but that's the beginning of it, when they found this pulsar. Yeah. And I think, and here's another interesting thing.
I wonder what they made of that in 1967.
Yeah, right. They had no idea. But the first extrasolar planet discovered was around a pulsar, of all things.
No kidding.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, if it's very consistent, as you say, though, it's probably a good place to look.
I guess, because it would, yeah, there'd be a transit or whatever, I guess.
All right. Every time, as we wrap things up on this day in history, we conclude with deaths. We leave you on a high note. And I've got a couple good ones. Oh, I think we got a lot of good ones today.
Yeah, I know. We got a lot of good deaths here.
I've got some nice ones for you.
Yeah, I got a couple. I don't even know who the hell you're talking
about. What? How is that possible?
Well, okay.
Well, let's go through
it. Go ahead.
1859, Washington Irving.
Him I know. Okay. Not one of my favorite authors. But, you know, he really, before Washington Irving came along, the British, Europeans really poo-pooed American authors.
Yes.
He was the one that...
They took a liking.
Yeah, they did.
They took a shining
respect for him.
Washington Irving.
Yeah.
Okay. Mm-hmm. He died on this date, November 28th in 1859. 1939, the death of Dr. James Naismith.
Tell him who he is.
He founded basketball.
Right. He used peach baskets. That's why it's called. Yeah.
He also basically, you know, very seldom is a sport just created almost out of thin air.
Interesting, though.
And he did. And it was, you know, it was just a thing to keep the guys active at the Y during the winter months.
And here's the interesting. That's Springfield, Massachusetts. The same place that I think his name was Morgan. He developed volleyball. He invented volleyball in the same city.
Oh, it's awesome.
Springfield, Massachusetts.
Yeah,
William Morgan, I think his name was.
Basketball became a great sport as soon as Dr. Naismith pinned up that second peach basket.
Fan?
Love it.
Yeah.
Oh my God! Basketball is a wonderful sport.
I love wrestling.
Sport.
I'm a wrestling fan.
You know,
those
go
guys
watch,
got all the good-looking
you
cheerleaders.
Go watch some Wallace Beery pictures. 1945, Dwight F. Davis, the American tennis player and politician. Well, the Davis Cup is named for Dwight F. Davis.
Right.
I want to come back to this one. I'm going to skip ahead. 1976, Rosalind Russell. I put this in just
great
for
you. Actress. You know, an interesting thing about Rosalind Russell, I think it was the 1948 Academy Awards. She had appeared in Morning Becomes Electra.
Okay.
And she was a great actress. And that was a great part. If you like that sort of thing. I'm not big on it, but Morning Becomes Electra, that is. If you want to see Rosalind Russell at her best, see His Girl Friday, one of my favorite movies of all time. But anyway, they're at the Academy Awards, and they say the winner is Loretta. I don't remember what happened, but I guess she thought that she was going to win, and she got up and started walking toward the stage, and it was Loretta Young won.
Oh, no.
Yeah, she had to go sit down. It was very embarrassing.
Goodness. Okay, 1977, American baseball player Bob Musial.
Interesting.
Dies. Now, Bob Musial was part of the greatest team ever, 1927 New York Yankees.
Well, some say that. I don't know. I'm not sure about
that. He played alongside
Murderer's Row.
Ruth, Gehrig, Lazeri, Cochran.
No. I think you're wrong there. I think it's Ruth. Murderer's Row, as I know it, Ruth, Gehrig, Lazeri, Earl Combs, the Kentucky Colonel.
He was the third baseman.
Mark Koenig.
Bill Dickey.
Bill Dickey probably would have been on. Yeah, he would have been a catcher.
Yes.
And then,
Cochran was the Athletics catcher.
Yeah. Who might have been better. I don't know.
I think Cochran was
was close.
Cochran was better. And the A's of that time were every bit as good as the Yankees.
They won.
But the reason you don't know the name Bob Musial better is because he's simply overshadowed by his teammates.
Hell yeah.
But he put up incredible numbers.
Pretty good
years. In any other team, he would have been the marquee player. And
not on
this
team,
no. In fact, he and Ruth were once suspended for the beginning of a season for doing a barnstorming tour because, you know, they would not quit playing. They would just, you know, form their own teams and head off west and south and just play. And they got in trouble, and Kennesaw Mountain Landis slapped a suspension on
He wasn't a real humorous guy either.
Yeah. In 1994, on this date,
another man probably not noted for
Jeffrey Dahmer dies. I think you know how that happened.
15 murders. Yeah, I think they killed him in the shower, didn't they? Beat him to death? Clubbed him to death or something?
I thought he was shivved in the shower.
Oh, okay. I thought he was beaten over the head. Him and another guy. There was another one got killed, too.
Yeah. And on this date in 2010, Leslie Nielsen, the great, great Canadian-American actor and producer, by the way, passed away. How can you forget?
Airplane. Funny.
Airplane.
And you know, he
police
was,
squad.
He was noted as a dramatic actor. I mean, it was only when he got older and later did in his career the, that right. he did the, you know, the, well, the deadpan humor that we know him for.
He did one more serious role in you know, when he was doing the Naked Gun.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
He did one more serious role.
What was
it? He was in Barbara Streisand and Richard Dreyfuss in a movie called Nuts.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
He's in that.
Oh, is he? Okay.
And it was literally disconcerting to see him because you're like, wait a second. What is this?
Yeah, you expect him to be. But I think he's like 90% deaf, too.
Really?
Yeah, Tori. Okay. Yeah, he was.
So let's go back to our closing death. On this date in 1954, the Italian-American physicist and academic, the Nobel Prize laureate winner, Enrico Fermi, passes away.
Yeah. Enrico Fermi, speaking of Chicago, pile number one under, was it Skaggs Field, a squash court, 1942.
Well, you say Chicago, but it's at the University of Chicago down
right.
in...
Yes, Skaggs Field, I believe it was underneath the squash court.
Mm-hmm.
The first sustained nuclear chain reaction. And they didn't know what the hell was going to happen when that happened. Which is an I don't want to take up too much time, but it's very interesting that the Germans never did. I mean, this is the beginning of this.
Can you imagine
Manhattan
if that had
project.
All gone wrong?
Yeah, who knows? Mm-hmm. They didn't know what was going to happen, but the Germans never did even get that far.
Do you think they couldn't have tried that a little bit further out in the country?
Yeah,
than,
you would think.
Than around a city
Chicago,
center of 3 million
of all
people?
Places. Yeah. But Fermi was in charge. I think I'd be in pretty, you know, we're in good hands.
Oh, okay.
But that guy, very. But the thing is, the Germans, of course, they were trying to develop the atom bomb, too. And they never quite got used to.
My understanding they kept having problems with the heavy water?
Yeah, basically to have a nuclear chain reaction, you can't have your striking uranium atoms with neutrons.
Well, this day in science brought
and
to
this
you by
blows.
Armand
yeah,
here.
This blows it apart, called fission, and then more neutrons hit more uranium atoms, et cetera, and you get a chain reaction. Well, you have to slow these neutrons down. Apparently, you can't just fire them willy nilly at you know. Half the speed of light.
Oh,
or
heavens, no.
So
no,
you have no, to use it. So what they call.
That'd be rude.
They use a moderator, which sometimes you need. You need to moderate. Mm-hmm. So you moderate, and that's basically what you do, is you slow down the neutrons. And they were using heavy water to do this. It wasn't that great. A moderator. We were using graphite rods, much better moderator, which is what they still use in nuclear reactors. When they want to slow them down, they put the rods in there. And we developed the bomb. They didn't. Now, here again, on Werner Heisenberg's birthday, we'll go into whether he actually sabotaged the German bomb project because he hated Hitler, or whether he's just stupid. That's one for the history. That's so
hated Hitler or stupid?
Yes.
On an upcoming edition.
Was Werner Heisenberg an idiot?
On an upcoming edition.
Or just a traitor.
Of This Day in History. Don't forget to check us out at thisdayinhistorypodcast.com. That is our website. Follow us on Facebook. Simply type in This Day in History Podcast and follow us. We will post the topics and we will ask you your opinion on what the biggest event you felt that affects your life to this day occurred on this day in history. For Armand Kachig and I'm Tony Hubert, we'll be back with you tomorrow when we discuss November 29th here on lineupmedia.fm.
This podcast was a presentation of lineupmedia.fm.